Yeah, man, I just finishing up my 18th report, and and then I've got to submit 6 more, and I'm like, shut the frick up, Brandon.
You know, oh, like, man. Was it the accent or the bug count that annoyed you when I told you?
You know, a little bit of both, you know. Just makes me feel like I'm in the bin, you know. Alrighty, hackers, fun little announcement before we jump into the episode this week. Brandon, Grep me, you know, you guys know him and love him from the pod, has been working with us for a long time. He's been running our hacker notes, and he's done an excellent job at that. But after probably 2 years of working with the pod, we have decided to graduate him to a co-host in light of his massive success in the bug bounty world lately in the live hacking events, and just going as a full-time hunter. I think we'd like to have him a little bit more in the spotlight and sharing his experiences. So Rezo isn't going anywhere. Don't worry. I'm not going anywhere. We will have 3 hosts of the podcast, yours truly, Rezo and Grepmi. And we will kind of hand off from week to week. But it's just been amazing to see his growth as a hacker. And I think he brings really good insights to the pod. So we just wanted to welcome him on as a co-host. So yeah, shoot him a DM, tell him you love him. He's doing a great job, and I'm excited to chat with him each week. Actually, I think this episode that we're running right now should have him on it. So, enjoy, and, yeah, definitely send him some love. All right, let's go. All right, hackers, we got a quick This Week in Bug Bounty segment for you this time around. It's kind of actually been a big week for Yes We Hack. They just landed an $8 million contract with the European Commission, becoming the new preferred bug bounty services provider in the EU. And I think these sort of things, as long in addition to what's going on in Iceland with their program, the European Union, we're seeing they're making moves in the bug bounty world. And I really want that to be successful, because then other parts of the world will learn from it and do the same. So very interesting stuff here. Yes We Hack also recently became a CNA, which is cool. So they can issue CVEs. And they launched, this is the opportunity I wanted to tell you guys about. They launched this open source bug bounty leaderboard here. There are already quite a few people rocking it on here, but if you're really into the open source scene, this could be a great place to look, find other hackers to collaborate with and programs to work on. All right, let's go back to the show. Dude, these are the weeks that we live for, man. Am I right? Like, these live hacking events bring, I just leave these live hacking events just brimming with energy and passion for bug bounty.
Oh, man, it's so good. It's so good. You get to see your friends. You get to hopefully completely crush the target and have some good war stories from it. It is top tier stuff. You just can't.
Good time.
You can't top it.
Yeah, dude. Okay, so let's set the scene a little bit here. I just got back from Sweden with the HackerOne live hacking event. Awesome. You are currently crushing it in an IPC with, is the target public for those or no?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
How many reports, dude? It's like 20 something reports, right?
So I checked the stats this morning. I spoke with J-Rock and he was like, man, you're responsible for half of the total reported reports.
That's my boy. Yes. Well done, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we had our little, you know, we used to call it our mentorship meeting. Now you've kind of graduated from this, but we had our little sync meeting, and you were like, yeah, you know, and I started one freaking day late on this competition, man. And you're like, yeah, man, I just finishing up my 18th report, and and then I've got to submit 6 more. And I'm like, shut the frick up, Brandon.
You know, man. Was it the accent or the bug count that annoyed you when I told you?
You know, a little bit of both, you know. Just makes me feel like I'm in the bin, you know. No, dude. But that's exciting, right? And so, I mean, how, bro?
Yeah, I done a little bit of prep before the event to help myself out, because it's been a while since I have actually committed some time to hunting. So a week before I really got into the event headspace, I sort of done what I could do around getting my information about some of the services that could have been in scope. I didn't know at the time. Mm-hmm. And I started looking around at the scope when it drops, and I have this I don't know, theory of like know your target is what I refer to it as when I'm trying to explain it. And I try and summarize what would hurt and where would hurt, and based on what scope is available, what I can do with that. So essentially, I'm really trying hard not to like give any details.
Come on, man. Like give us a little juice, just a tiny little bit of juice.
Well, I was fortunate enough to use a bug to gain some information from another part of the app. And although the bugs aren't chained, the information was quite useful because I could deduct a lot from what I had. Say no more. That is it. Okay. My lips are sealed.
I see. Okay, so this is a little bit more. This is a little shout to the bug bounty metagaming here, which is like when you are finding vulnerabilities and gadgets as well. You know, gadgets that can leak information, but you got to keep a big picture mentality here, right? It's not necessarily like you are always just going to find the bug, report the bug, and then it's fresh slate and you move to the next one, right? Sometimes you can use what you learned from those bugs or use some of the information revealed via those bugs to inform other vulnerabilities. And in fact, you should if you're looking to optimize your earnings, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just really dug deep, tried to understand the threat model, tried to understand all of the apps, and sort of got a bit of a feel for what I would perform well on. And that's another thing as well. When you're looking at scope and you're trying to get a feel for it, try and look for your flavors of hunting on that scope and see. Because I doubled down. I was like, okay, I probably would do okay here. And I was right this time. And dude, I also done a collab with the big dogs as well.
Wow, did you really? Okay.
Yeah, with all the right. Big dogs. So that's gonna be a fun one if it comes through. But
well, I think you messaged me, right? I don't know if I can dox your DMs here, but like you messaged me and you're like, hey man, I've got this cool thing. And then like I see like 2 hours later, wasn't at my phone, you're like, shit, you know, Franz popped it. it's like, ah, dang it. You know,
What was interesting, I kept that conversation going, or we kept that conversation going, and we actually figured out we could do some other things on another endpoint. So we got a really nice bug out of that as well. So it's good. But
I wanted to say, just going back to before we moved along from your principle that you shared just a second ago, I totally think that's true in trying to align the scope to your like capabilities and stuff like that, and figure out which app in scope is like, you know, you have an advantage on as a hunter. But one of the things that I've, you know, just consistently come back to lately is, you know, I am intimidated by a good amount of scope, like desktop applications, binaries, some mobile stuff, you know, like just there's a good amount of that I am afraid of. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I try to go after that because that's where the impact is and I can see that clearly. And I always am happy that I did that. You know, like I have never not been happy that I've done that. And I just think that's really odd because I feel like I should fail at that sometimes, you know, and I feel like I should come out with like, this is a little bit of a hit or miss, you know, like, but really every single time I've done it, it's been like, wow, that was great. You know?
Yeah. I remember you saying that about a few events, actually. I feel like there's two things that come into play, though, is really understanding the threat model and also having a good foundation to rely on in terms of technical ability, because there are a lot of principles and concepts which will be cross-applicable regardless of what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you obviously have very, very strong foundations to tap into. So just look at whatever, man. You'll find bugs. You'll be fine.
It could be that. Yeah. But I also think a lot of other hackers are intimidated by the same things you're likely intimidated by.
For sure.
And, you know, they probably haven't had eyes on it. And actually, this is something that I was thinking about recently. And I was on a run and I was thinking about, you know, your conversation about starting your pen test company or whatever, because you've had a lot of inbound. And I was thinking, you know, one of the really cool things that I would like to see some people market in a pen test company is a pen test company that only looks at the intimidating part of your scope, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not your first pen test company. This is the company that is going to go deep and get the things that other people shied away from because they have a responsibility to do coverage on other parts of the apps, right? And so like, let's talk about a normal pen test situation. You know, you hire the company, they come in, you've got 80 hours to do the pen test. 60 hours, 70 hours is, oh, I need to cover all of the web endpoints and I need to like check them for all of the normal stuff and, you know, some logic bugs or whatever, right? That takes up the bulk of your time. And then, you know, you have maybe 10, 15 hours to look for these crazy deep bugs, right? Not enough, right? Mm. And so they don't do it. And then, okay, you're like, okay, I fixed some of those things. Well, guess what? The next guys that are going to do the next pen test, they've got to go through and they've got to do their due diligence on those same applications, the same endpoints, right? And you know, maybe they'll find something different because they've got a different set of eyes and a different way of perceiving those pieces of functionality. But it's unlikely that anybody is going through all of the hoops to configure all of the stuff like we see in Bug Bounty, right? Mm. Like that's why we find crazy stuff in Bug Bounty is because we are digging deeper and we're not confined by this, by a need to cover everything, because we can cover whatever the heck we want, right?
100%.
And I think it would be a really interesting differentiator for a pen test company to say, hey, listen, we're going to ignore all of the basic scope. Give it to the other pen test companies, okay? We are just going to go for the stuff that's very deep and very technical in your app. And you know, spend time there. We may not find anything, but we may find something that breaks the whole world, you know?
For sure. So sort of like a flavor of red teaming, but for web apps and that sort of hardcore, like in the weeds type research.
Yeah. I think it could be very good. And we see some of this stuff with like Cure 53 and stuff like that, right? Where they're going super deep on stuff. But I don't know that they're putting it in their marketing material that it's like, hey, listen, we're not going to find your access control bugs. You know, like it's not going to happen. Mm. We're going to focus on this, you know?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting thought. I feel like there would be a lot of appetite as well for some of the bigger security companies that want that to go through their budget to improve. And also for actual bug bounty companies as well, before adding new scope to in program, that's exactly what they'd want to do. Mm. Let's talk about that after.
Yeah. Why are we doing this on air? Shit. Okay. All right. Anyway, let's get to the actual content of the app. Oh, wait. No. I didn't even get to talk about my life hacking.
So how did your stuff go? I heard from somewhere you might have done very well from this event. Yeah, dude.
Frick. Let me check right now because I think they're still paying out some of the stuff. I'm still, as of the recording this, in first place, just barely sliding above the team baguette. French guys, which is amazing. But yeah, man, it was a great event. This one was in Sweden, which is actually one of my top places in the world to go. And I found a couple good bugs that I was actually able to get escalated to criticals because of some nuances in their threat model that would not traditionally be criticals. And so that was good. And then yeah, man, just sat down and pumped it out on a very difficult piece of scope and found, you know, the super crit that you need to like seal a good event, right? Because I feel like, you know, just going back to the live hacking event strategy thing, I feel like if you want to crush it at an event, you've got to have like good performance across the board, you know, get your mediums in there, get your highs in there, get, you know, one crit, two crits, and then one mega crit. Right. Mm-hmm. That kind of seals the deal. At least, 100%. You know, if you get one mega crit that's like, oh no, like this is the end of the world, then that really solidifies the event for you. So that's what I was going for.
So I wanted to talk to you about that because there's this, I've had it in a few of the other events and I'm really digging deep to try and find something obscure. It's taken me a bunch of time. Mm-hmm. I enter, panic's not the right word, but like this mindset of, oh no, I'm not reporting something. Do I go for volume or do I go deep in this? Do you experience that at all? And how do you combat that? Because it almost blocks my ability to go really deep in the weeds sometimes. And it's very frustrating.
Yeah, I think I think I do. And I think that was something I struggled with more earlier in my live hacking event career, but still struggle with. And that is why, you know, in the beginning, I spent a lot of time, and just like you did this event, I was so hyped when I heard you say this, because I'm like, that's my guy. But, you know, going for volume, trying to get a feel of these applications, right? Getting a decent amount of base reports in, And then you've already done, you know, a good amount of, you know, like looking into a specific app, right? And I would say volume in a specific app. Like mm-hmm. I would really not endorse jumping from app to app to app to app. I would say volume in a specific app. And then, you know, after the dupe window closes or after you feel like you've got a good base of reports or understandings, then kind of shooting your shot for those deeper bugs, right? I've done that post dupe window. The con of this approach is that sometimes the mega crits that people find right off the bat will get fixed and you'll miss them, you know?
So. Yeah. I mean, it's again, finding the strategy that works for you fundamentally, because different people, like there's a few LHE hackers that run their game in a way which would just give me a meltdown and I'd be, I can't do this.
Yeah.
So again, I think it just comes back to, as you said, that experience and finding your flow, because everyone looks for different bug classes. Different bug classes require varying context of the application, varying understanding. And it's all unique, I guess, is my point.
It is, man. It's a very unique ecosystem. It's a good thing that we've got variety too. And I think some hackers just don't give a lily and they show up and they hack whatever they want to hack. And I think that's cool, you know? But I think, yeah, and to some degree, I aspire to that. But I also aspire to really consistently performing at these live hacking events. And I think that my methodology and the methodology you implemented here, I think, is one of the most reliable ways to reliably perform, right? And whereas you'll see some people that knock mega crits on day two at some events and then don't find anything at other events.
Yeah, 100%. I feel like we might have to edit that out because that's a very valuable meta strategy.
Yeah.
that people are going to use against us.
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, that's the give and take of the pod, man. Like I, especially lately, I've been realizing like, dang, like some of the stuff that we distribute on the pod stings sometimes when it comes back to like be used against you in a competition.
Dude, one of my most prized gadgets that I use in so many chains that I mentioned on my first pod episode has been patched since that went out. And I only noticed this like 2 weeks ago.
What is it?
Maybe Which three one? Weeks ago. It was the, on a target that I look at quite often in a certain part of their ecosystem, the OAuth mode where you can force a redirect.
Yeah.
Just without sort of like, it's just by design, but they've patched it and it completely, I was getting so excited. I was like, I've got something just for this. And then nothing. I was like,
no.
I shouldn't have said it on the pod. I just should have just left it.
Yeah. And sometimes, and like we discussed before this episode, you know, you do have to kind of watch the things you say, because these companies do, like, especially the companies that we're talking about under, you know, I guess behind the scenes a little bit right now, they all listen to the podcast, you know? And so it's like, all right. But
it's
yeah,
part I think of it. It's part
it
of
is. It is. And it's a part of the give and take of the industry as well. We are standing on the shoulders of giants in so many ways, you know? And so, yeah, I guess it's part of the game.
Before we move on, I did want to talk about some of your takeaways, because you have some very unconventional pieces of wisdom in here, which I'd like you to double okay. click on.
So I want to be clear about this. These takeaways are a mix of experiences from this last live hacking event and from talking to other hackers at the live hacking event about their experiences at LHEs and in hacking over the past like couple weeks now, or couple months. I want to disclaim here, I always get people's permission before I share these things. So don't you frickers come up to me and be like, oh, can't tell Justin anything because he's going to yap about it on the pod. I always get permission before I talk about something on the pod. So anyway, with that being said, here are a couple fun takeaways. Okay. One, sometimes you fight with a WAF, okay? And that is a very unpleasant experience. And most of the time we win our battles with WAFs. It's just persistence, it's encodings, it's understanding quirks of the system. It's, you know, stripping or sanitization that occurs on the backside of the WAF, right? All of those things can lead you to bypassing WAFs, or contextually aware WAFs as well, you know, trying to abuse that. The problem is sometimes they've just got like a includes rule and they just auto deny. And it's like, there's nothing you can do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the hackers I was speaking with, I had a situation like this recently, and they were saying that the way that they actually ended up exploiting it was internal employees for this company are not routing through the WAF. Their DNS internally resolves to directly to the host. So while all of the users of the company, you know, were hitting Cloudflare or Akamai or whatever it was, when an employee clicked to the link, there was no WAF in front of it, and the bug would pop, right? And in the specific context the guy was telling me about, internal employees were one of the prime targets for this bug. They had a delivery mechanism through the business logic, right? So it was just like perfect storm. But I hadn't really thought about that before. So I wanted to shout that out. And I also just don't have really any good ideas on how to test whether this is possible without actually like having a contact at the company.
Yeah, it's tough because those sort of context switches are what you'll only really see when you're looking at, say, like blind XSS bugs, mm-hmm. typically, isn't it? Because they're being detonated from a different context. Mm. In terms of how, man, you'd need some serious threat modeling and guessing, I think, in order to get to that. And you'd also need the bugs to line up in the sense that you actually can deliver a canary of some description to even test it. So I'll say it's definitely rarer from what I can think.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well, like blind XSS is an interesting point. You know, you could definitely test it with a blind XSS. If you're just looking for, if you have a blind XSS and you are trying to do what you were saying, like use the bug to gain more information about your target, which is a little bit red teamy, a little bit pivoty, but you know, ask forgiveness rather than permission there sometimes. But I was also thinking when you said that, actually, maybe this could be a good use for blind SSRFs, is if you've got like a only status code blind SSRF, what you could do is try to hit an asset from that blind SSRF in, you know, that's a public facing asset from within the company and it, you know, put a malicious string, let's just do like your normal script alert, right? Mm-hmm. In the query params. And if it hits that server and doesn't give a 403, then you're not getting blocked by the WAF, right? But if it does, then you know that you are routing through the WAF.
Yeah, so that's good.
Interesting thing you could potentially use a blind SSRF to kind of give you some intel about the company for.
That's good. Yeah. But that comes with its own caveats of you don't actually know the segment you are calling out from internally and what that looks like. But it's still a potential gadget nonetheless.
Yeah, it doesn't say that it's not the case, but if it works, then you do know that it is the case.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's like a...
Yeah, that's some big brain stuff.
That's like some... I know there's some like logical like... if A is B and B is C, then A is C or whatever, like thing that I can do there, but I can't wrap my head around it while I'm talking.
Yeah, don't look at me, mate. I can't do that on the spot either. Give me 10 minutes and I might be able to.
Okay, so that's takeaway number one. Can circumvent WAF sometimes for internal employees, not routing through, you know, external DNS. Number two. Secondary context bugs, I've always struggled with exploiting. And I've done it, you know, a couple dozen times probably. But I just, whenever I look at them, unless it's really verbose and it's really just dumping back exactly what's happening on the backend API, sometimes I really struggle with it because it's like, you know, they're expecting a certain format in the JSON structure of the response. And sometimes you're getting partial fields back and sometimes you're not getting anything back. And it's like, one tip that I did get from a hacker at this live hacking event, and they actually showed me the bug from a couple months ago that they exploited, was that secondary context bugs can also be exploited to bypass access controls within a like RBAC environment, which is very interesting. Like, sometimes what you'll see in apps is that, you know, they've got maybe like your organization ID or your account ID or whatever in the URL, right? And if you try to mess with that at all, you're done, you're cooked, right? Like it just has to be there as a part of the path for the API. And that's where all their access controls are done. But sometimes that's done by a front-end service. So if you have a secondary context path traversal, you may be able to provide a organization or an account ID in the path that you own, right? So that you're an admin on, but then you're also in a different organization where you're just a lower privilege user, and then overwrite that on the secondary context, traverse back up, and then build out the whole path again. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I just almost always thought about this from the context of cross-org attacks. And I think obviously that's where you should go first. But if you're really stumped on cross-orgs attack, definitely try to exploit same org RBAC implementation and make sure that extends past the first proxy into the secondary API as well.
This is so painful because there's so much I want to talk about, but I can't from this event. But that exact scenario is, I'm working with something now and I've been testing this theory all morning. Hopefully I can talk about it next time, but it's very good way to look at things because once you start getting those sort of gadgets, it can turn something which was weird behavior into a really, really nice bug. Just by thinking about architecturally, where are those access controls implemented? And if you can get a verbose error or something like that to disclose that as well, which I may or may not have done somewhere. I'm going to stop talking.
Dude, yeah, it's crazy because, the bug that the guy showed me, it's on a different target than the one you're working on. And it's interesting that we're seeing this. This is when you know you're giving good tips. Guys, this is what's so exciting to me about critical thinking now is I love it when we get to talk about stuff like this. And I know that many top tier hackers are listening to this being like, I'm going to change my methodology because of this. You know, that's our North Star with critical thinking and even with you coming on as the co-host, which by the way, after we started, I decided I'm going to record a preempt to this episode and explain that. So
they already know
about that.
Good.
It's, one of the North Stars for the podcast is making sure that elite hackers, intermediate to advanced level hackers are getting a takeaway every single week that modifies their methodology that makes them be a better hacker, right? If we're doing just one of those every week, then we're winning, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's just hope we don't dupe on any of these bugs now.
Shucks. Yeah. Okay. All right. Last one. I'll keep this one brief. I don't know. This is something that I was in Sweden, so I was hanging out with Franz and Matthias, and these guys are just legendary. And I always leave conversations with them thinking like, man, I do not theorize what's happening in the backend pipelines nearly as much as I should, And especially in an environment when you're working with an amazing team and you can have a conversation with them about like, hey, is this what's going on in your backend or, whatever, it just opens my eyes to like, that is a very logical deduction that I could have made from a black box perspective. And I just need to start flexing those muscles a little bit more.
That is exactly it. I recall there was a time at some point last year when I messaged you after Franz dropped a crazy bug. And I was like, what have you done this week to think more like Franz when you're approaching a target? And I remember messaging you like four times. Mm. But yeah, I think he's the best example of it when the research on the, do you remember the headers when he like shelled through the
through the request ID? Logging headers. Yeah. It's
like, that is like the perfect research. If you haven't seen it, go and check out the old hacker notes because that is like the perfect highlight of using that. What can we deduct from a black box scenario? Perfect of exactly that. And it's just insane.
One of the things I've realized from this too, from talking to Franz and Matthias though, is that like Matthias is, I've highlighted Matthias many times on this podcast because of the amazing hacker that he is, but he continues to be underrated, man. Like Matthias is every bit like as good at that as Franz is. And you just don't hear about it quite as much.
So I feel like he doesn't make as much content though, compared, I might be wrong on that.
We're fixing that though.
Okay.
We are. I sent him a mic for the pod. And to be honest, man, I've used his Archive Alchemist tool a bunch. We talked about it on the pod. He covered it in an episode. Super good tool.
Mm.
And really, really excellent for finding critical vulnerabilities. And guys, like, if you haven't watched that episode, go back and watch that episode whenever you actually have the opportunity to test an archive upload, okay? Because I did that recently when I was testing some stuff, and I had such a blast with it, and I got some really impactful stuff out of it. And now I feel, so much more comfortable with that tool, you know? And I've got muscle memory for it. I know exactly what it can do. And now that I've done it at least once, testing the whole methodology that he outlined in that episode, I just feel like I've got a grip on it now, and I will not shy away at all from archive-related vulnerabilities moving forward. I will run to them, you know, because I've got the tool and the methodology to exploit them.
Yeah, man, I've been waiting. I really have been waiting, but nothing as of yet. So I'll keep an eye out and hope something cool comes up.
Keep an eye out, man. All right, that's what I had for my live hacking events, you know, chats and takeaways. Let's get into some news content, shall we? First up on the news, actually, we've got Gareth Hayes dropping stuff, as always. And this one was particularly interesting, I thought, y'all, because he's using this attributes. For those of you that are on YouTube, you can check it out. But he's using the attributes reference inside of an HTML on event handler. So he's got input on focus and then attributes 0.value. So he's reassigning the first attribute of the specific HTML element, which is in fact the on focus that he's presently in, and then reassigning what JavaScript should be run upon execution of this function here. And then he uses that to smuggle data in from the hash, which is contained in the URL reference, and redefine what the actual JavaScript is being run when that on event handler occurs. So I know that that's a little bit dense there, but the main takeaways here that I think the hunter should have is that if you need to smuggle data, maybe you've got like a specific character set that you can't get past, because this is pretty character set liberal, you can reassign attributes inside of your HTML element, so input on focus or whatever, using the data from the URL reference, which is only valid inside of an HTML tag. Very brilliant approach here by Gareth. And I did have a little demo. Do you understand what I'm saying, Grant, or is this just like...
Yeah, so for me, like, I'm looking at you saying these words and I get like 1/5 of the context before my brain goes, nope. And then I get the other 1/5. And
okay.
It's like, nope.
Okay. Look at this. Look at this lab really quickly, because he linked this lab as well. Okay. So the on click for this input is attributes 0. So the first attribute dot value equals, you know, backtick plus URL plus backtick. Okay. So essentially it's saying, hey, take the current URL, stick it inside of the first attribute, which is the onclick, and put it inside of template literals, the backticks, right? So then what you do is when you click it, look what happens. Now it takes the current URL, sticks it inside of backticks, nice. Right? And then from the hash, you grab the $ curly brackets alert 1, which allows you to execute code inside of the template literal, right? And then when you click it again, you get the pop. Right. Nice. So it's priming the data in the hash with $ curly brackets alert 1, right? And then it's using the attributes 0.value to take the data from the URL, stick it inside of the on event handler, and then when you trigger it, it triggers the actual code that's in the URL to be run. Right?
So does he just sit at his desk and goes, you know what? I think this might work. And then he just writes that and it works. Like, how
I think he does, dude. I think he actually does do that.
Like, I see some of these things when I'm scrolling on Twitter and I laugh out loud because I just think, how has someone just concocted that? And everything he posts is just so good.
It's freaking good, man. And I will say, for those of you that are not like client-side, like loving client-side stuff, if you are, you should definitely be investigating this. But if you don't, your major takeaways here are using the attributes reference to redefine attributes on your current HTML tag, and then knowing that URL, the string URL, all caps, is a way to reference essentially the document URI in only when you are inside of an on-event handler.
Doesn't it reference something else when you're outside of a non-event handler?
Yeah, exactly. Entirely? So it's like, if you just type URL, it doesn't typically, it's like a type, right? It's a constructor. But if you're actually doing it inside of the function, inside of like a on-click event or something like that, then, okay, well, it didn't update it now. But yeah, you can see right here, that's the document URI.
Nice.
Right?
Nice.
Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, he is... His brain needs to be preserved and studied. It's just like one of those things where crazy, crazy content continuously as well.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Definitely PortsFigure Research. They've got some amazing stuff coming out.
They do. On that note, Hooli, he's had a lot of love on the pod. They, I should say, on the pod before. Is back with some more research, which will help you digest some of that Gareth Hayes magic. Really, really good write-up, good blog. And what I love about this, and really warms the heart upon opening, if you have any thoughts on my blog and articles you want to let me know, you can either post a comment or tell me via this feedback form. They are actively looking for feedback from the community. Is that not like such a nice thing?
Has a feedback form on their free blog, dude.
That's just crazy. Like, that is so nice of them.
That is such a commitment to quality.
Yeah, yeah, so good. Anyway, the actual blog itself does a really nice job of breaking down some of these more exotic payloads that you might see, and exactly how some of these tag template literals work.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. Why, just like we were talking about just a second ago.
Exactly. Why they work, and some of the context that would be useful for them to actually work in, which I thought was really good. I know, again, we've mentioned so much of their research on the blog before, but I really, really like the way they break down every single subject, give you every single topic, and give you some of the applicable use cases as well. And just a really nice writing style, which I've grown an appreciation for since the Hacker Notes, I must admit.
Yeah. Well, dude, I mean, I love this one that you've got on the screen right here, which is, you know, on error equals eval, and then throw equals alert one. Like, that's so fun. Like, just being able to use those error handlers and then the throw keyword, it really allows you to get around some character restrictions.
Yeah, it's like using your error message as a payload. But then they just keep breaking down these payloads and how you can further eliminate syntaxes that might be giving you a problem. Really nice. Useful if you're being blocked by a WAF, for example. Very useful if you're not as comfortable with client-side stuff like me. Like, this is the perfect content. And it probably builds upon some of Gareth Hayes's content in his JavaScript for Hackers book, which I have committed to myself to read end to end. I always get part of the way through and I'm like, this is some heavy stuff, and never commit to it. I will commit to it. I will do it.
Yeah. Dude, and then, that is definitely one of the seminal works, you know, in making you a good client-side hacker.
100%. And then the thing I did want to give a shout out is, like, they give the mother payload at the end, this absolute, I want to call it a monstrosity, but it isn't. It's like art. Just look at that. And it only works in Chrome. And again, such a good job of breaking it down, exactly how it's working. And
yeah, they've got, this is without quotes, it looks like. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've abstracted away the quotes with, decimal representation of strings, and then forcing a conversion with a regex there. That's pretty sick.
Bro, honestly, it's just insane. So, hats off to them, because every piece of content they put out is just like so in depth, so in the weeds, and overall really good read. And then they give you a few key points at the end. Commas can chain multiple expressions returned in the last one. Replacing the on error with eval allows you to execute the error message as code. Errors thrown will become part of the error message. And as long as you can turn the error message into valid code, you've succeeded.
Dude, that I love that. Those four at the end there, that's really good. Okay, I'm going to say them again. Commas can chain multiple expressions returning the last one. That's pivotal, because you often will want to control the return value while getting something done. Right? Replacing on error with eval allows you to execute the error message as code. That's a really good one. Error's Throne will be a part of the error message itself. So converting the error message into valid code. And then as long as you can do that, you are avoiding syntax errors in getting your payload through.
Yeah. Dude, I feel like you should get that as like a tattoo, like the quote on your arm for being a client side hack.
That's beautiful, man. For syntax or character set restricted environments, this is like the new go-to.
Yeah, and they give you a lot of that context throughout the blog post as well. I can't see where it is, but exactly where it would be useful and why it would be useful. So worth a read for you guys, which aren't as handy on the client side as like me, really.
Mm. Yeah, good stuff, man. Mm. Pivoting a little bit from, actually, you know what? Tell you what, we'll stick with the client side stuff for just a second longer. And I'm not going to spend too much time and dwell on this one because it's not strictly relevant to hacking. Mm. But there is an amazing write-up here of Google's Safe Content Frame. And if you are at all interested, if any of the listeners here, I know a lot of you guys have AppSec jobs. If your requirements for your company require, you know, you to render an arbitrary HTML file, that is very hard to do in a safe way. And, you know, preserve isolation of code, isolation of your domain, right? Because we can set cookies up to the top level domain. Very difficult problem to solve. I have spent a lot of time trying to crack Safe Content Frame that Google has produced to fix this problem. And it's bulletproof, man. Like, it is really bulletproof. And so if you're interested in understanding how exactly all that works, you can see how it works here. They combine a isolated domain with and a public suffix list registration with delivery via iframe that checks event source and blobs. And this is the key part right here. The hashing of the content and the parent origin to create a unique subdomain of these domains, which makes it impossible for you to even like, you can't affect the code because the parent origin changes. And if the code changes at all inside of it, then it changes the hash. So it's like, this is painful. But really, really well done by the Google team. And this is, I think, the go-to solution if you have to render untrusted HTML inside of your app.
Now, is this a new thing or has this been around for a while and they've just improved upon it?
It's been around for a while. This is the first write-up I've seen that like fully explains it from the engineering side, but okay. There have been a lot of CTFs run on it because the Google team is like, hey, hack this, you know? And yeah, it's pretty freaking bulletproof. And I know that Terzhank, who was mentioned in the last article you had up, was one of the main engineers for this. And it's freaking good, dude. It's really, really good.
Well, have the client side guys got their hands on it? Jorian and co in the channel, because I'm sure they have.
Yeah. I mean, I we've talked about it before. And I mean, it's just, there's just not much, there's like, it painfully uses the right structure. I mean, that hashing that creates the unique domain and you know, having the public suffix list, there's nothing you can do. Like that just completely isolates everything.
One of those annoying ones. Will it pain you as much as the Coop headers did?
I don't know, man. Coop is the worst. Coop is like really a pain in my butt. The thing is, even if you can get a frame reference to this thing, dude, which is a problem in and of itself, there's just nothing. There's no attack surface. So.
Yeah.
I spent so much time. I was like, you know what, guys, I'm gonna assess this. And the Terzhank was over there laughing, like, all right, bro, like, take a stab at it. And I'm like,
nothing.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Because
actually, I will say, I did find a problem with the implementation of it somewhere though, in Google's infrastructure. So.
Well, that's something.
Like, yeah. There's nothing wrong with this itself, but the way that they took this and implemented it was not to spec. And so I was able to abuse something there.
Oh, there you go. You're fine then. Good stuff. I think the next one I'd want to jump in on is a very, very good write-up on Microsoft Entra. Let me just share my screen. Okay. And there's a reason why I did want to cover it, because the depth that this thing goes into is just insane. And
One token to rule them all, obtaining global admin in every Entra ID tenant via actor tokens. Jeez.
Honestly, the reason I wanted to cover this is because we've used the term mega crit on the pod before, and this is literally an unstoppable mega crit that they could have done nothing about because there's no detection for it. Mm-hmm. So if people aren't familiar, Microsoft Entra is essentially Azure AD, but the newer version rehashed. And it's pretty much their cloud identity service. So it can be quite the target for a lot of red team assessments. And the whole crux of the problem is, essentially, I'll dive into the impact in a minute. I just want to give some context. You have these things called actor tokens, which are used by some services to essentially imitate a user or service and do so with godlike permissions, in the sense that you can use the service but not actually be the user that initiated it. It also uses the Microsoft Graph API and Azure AD Graph API, which is somewhat applicable to Bug Bounty because Bug Bounty programs are run on both of them as well. And this is the sort of content that will help you attack those APIs perfectly. So the overview of the actor tokens is that they were essentially tokens issued by the access control service, and this guy didn't know what this service was, but he guessed that it was a legacy thing used by SharePoint applications. And if you've ever had an encounter with SharePoint, you know it's pretty awful. It's pretty bad.
Always a bad time.
Exactly.
I was a SharePoint admin for that was my first like real job in IT, was being a SharePoint admin, and I did not stay in that job for very long.
Yeah, no wonder you went to Bug Bounty so quickly, mate. That's tough. Anyway, the whole way this finding came about is that he was examining an exchange flow, and in this exchange flow, in a hybrid setup, essentially Exchange would request an actor token when it wants to communicate with another service. Now, as I said earlier, the actor token allows it to imitate that service or user that it's using. And this is the overview of the token. For listeners, it is a JWT, but a lot of the claims are GUIDs, so they look like absolute nonsense, and unless you were really deeply rooted into the ecosystem, you probably wouldn't have any idea what any of these correspond to. But luckily, this guy is so far embedded into this ecosystem, he knew everything. So
love to see it, man. Love to see that depth.
This is why I had to give this a shout out, because so many good pieces of information in this and the breakdown. And essentially, the audience and all the claims are GUIDs for what you're requesting. And the main thing here, which is actually readable, is the trusted for delegation value, which is true. And that is what allows the actor token to be an actor token. Now, in the next part of the flow of this exchange functionality I was looking at, Exchange would embed the token that we just covered into an unsigned JWT, which is then sent to the resource provider, which was Azure Graph. Now, essentially, they've taken a wrapped token, which was signed, and then placed it in a completely unsigned JWT, my bad. But they are using values from the unsigned JWT to make assumptions or decisions based on the authentication of that user. Now, don't know why they've done that, but we'll carry on.
Why did they do that? The world will never know.
Yeah, why they've done that, who knows? Now, in the unsigned JWT, you have a name ID, which originates from the Azure AD Graph API, and more importantly, you have UPN. No, that one doesn't matter for now. Now, these impersonation tokens, especially all these claims specify the service you want to impersonate, and none of them are signed. So once Exchange has that token, it can use it to impersonate anyone against the target service it requested for 24 hours, by the way. Mm-hmm. Now, this is hilarious because, and this is taken directly from the blog, it lacks almost every security control you would want. There's no logs when
don't skip the line before that. In my personal opinion, this whole actor token design is something that should never have existed. Go ahead.
It lacks almost every security control you'd want. There's no logs when actor tokens are issued. Since these services can graft unsigned impersonation tokens without talking to Entra, there are no logs when they are created or used. They cannot be revoked. They completely bypass any restrictions configured in conditional access. And we have to rely on login from the resource provider. Now, this is just absolutely insane that these sort of things are kicking about in the ecosystem. And this next screenshot is really sums it up. So you have the signed actor token, but then the unsigned JWT is what's actually being used for some of the impersonation. And that is unsigned, which you can just put whatever in, send it off, providing you have that signed actor token.
Wow. That's really weird. It looks like for the audio listeners, we're looking at the breakdown of a JWT. So you see the header, right, in the close parentheses, and then you're looking at the body, and you see inside of that JWT a field called actor token, which contains a signed JWT. But then you also see following that a bunch of fields that you would expect to see in the JWT, AUD, ISS, etc. And this is an unsigned token. And then I guess it's using those values from the unsigned JWT rather than the signed JWT inside of the unsigned JWT. Am I representing that right?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. So you've got two different checks being performed. You've got the first check, which actually gives you the actor token to make sure it's valid and you're requesting something valid. But then they go ahead and wrap that in an unsigned JWT and make assumptions based off of what you want to assume on the unsigned JWT.
Okay, Brandon, let me ask you this here. I'm sorry to interrupt because I know this is a complex bug. But I think what might be a good global takeaway here for us is that if we see a JWT that contains another JWT, look at the fields that are shared between the two. Because I could totally see how this would happen, right? Essentially, they are looking at the top level JWT instead of the embedded one. Mm-hmm. And all they needed, to fix their code even, was, dot, here, scroll up a little bit. What's the name of that? Yeah, dot actor token, dot AUD, right? Rather Absolutely. Than dot AUD. Right?
Absolutely.
So if there's any embed and then overlap in the body of those JWT tokens, that could be a really good area for us to test.
Absolutely. And I feel like as well, this blog for me summarizes perfectly. When you're looking at a target with so many interconnected and interacting services, that depends on another service to perform its authentication, for example, and completely trust that it is the absolute truth. There's so much gold in that, man, especially when you have two different APIs kicking around. Like one of these APIs is actually only there and being phased out, and it's there for backwards compatibility issues. And there's been so many bugs come off the back of it. And yeah, like the whole write-up, very, very good. It covers the practical abuse, this exact impact. It could basically use a token from its own tenant to go cross-tenant and impersonate anyone using publicly available IDs, of which aren't, even though they are GUIDs in some instances, they're not secret. You can retrieve them. And if you've ever looked at any of the Azure or Microsoft Bug Bounty program, you will know that there are so many ways to disclose some of this information. I know quite a few hunters on that.
Yeah, dude, programs. It says, okay, find the net ID of a regular user. Craft the impersonation, use that impersonation to list all global admins on the tenant and get their net ID, and then impersonate those and then do whatever the heck you want. That's nasty, man. That's super nasty.
Crazy. And if you are thinking about attacking some of these services, start off with this blog because it gives you exactly where and how to find some of these net IDs and even some of the impacts of the threat model when you are looking at cross-tenant, inter-tenant, and also abusing the actual APIs. And we could talk about this right up for about an hour, so I will try and wrap it up because there is so much content packed into here. But the last thing I did want to cover, they've got detections and everything like that, is this last bit here, the very last part of the blog, I do not have access to any tenants in the national cloud deployment, so I was not able to test whether the vulnerability existed there. Since national cloud deployments use their own token signing keys, it's unlikely that it would have been possible to execute this attack from a tenant in the public cloud to one of these national clouds. I do consider it likely that this attack would have worked across tenants in the same national cloud deployment. That level of understanding and expertise on a service is like master level. And whenever this person now brings out a blog or any content about Entra, Azure Graph, or anything related, I will trust them absolutely, because you don't get this sort of information just by playing around with these things. You spend a serious amount of time to understand that.
Yeah, dude, I'm gonna just click on their X directly from this article, and yeah, dang it, I'm not following them. I've been missing out. I'm gonna turn on notifications. That's pretty sick.
Yeah, so good, man.
I love that you read that little line. This is like a grayed out line at the very bottom in the like sub notes as well, Brandon, at the bottom. So props to you for being very thorough in your assessment of this write up. And I think that also is a vote of confidence, you know, to hear this researcher say that. For me, in sort of nation segmented cloud environments, right, where you know you'll have like, you know, US government AWS or whatever, or you know, that sort of thing sort of segmented off, I was like in the past I've been like, okay, that might be a little bit overboard, you know, bureaucracy saying okay, everything's got to be segmented. Mm-hmm. But it's cool to see that such an impactful vulnerability like this actually, you know, it was limited by mm-hmm. that sort of nation-based cloud segmentation, if I'm understanding what he's saying correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like it sums up perfectly. Once you have so much context on some of these services, you can really dig deep into the threat model to the extent that you can understand whether deployment locations and these more segregated environments would be affected by knowing that they use their own token signing keys. Like, honestly, hats off to this guy. It's very commendable, the depth and level of research that they've done on this one. Very, very good.
Totally, man. Totally. That's dirkjanm.io. So definitely check that out if you guys want to add that to like your RSS list or whatever. Next up, a little bit lighter, we've got FlareProx. FireProx is actually one of the tools I use very often, despite that episode with Ryan from Akamai saying like, hey Justin, that's illegal, don't do that, that breaks the terms and services or whatever. So anyway, if you're looking to not do that, then do it through Cloudflare instead. with FlareProx and get, you know, essentially, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, essentially this abuses sort of ephemeral cloud environments like Workers and I guess like, you know, API Gateway in the AWS one, to get you new IPs for every single request. So if you're dealing with a strong amount of rate limiting and you really need fuzz, then you're going to want to use FireProx or FlareProx to do that. And that is, this one is popped up that uses the Cloudflare IP space to avoid detections and blocks.
Nice.
And the code looks pretty solid. I mean, I will say one that's a little bit weird with this. I know that FireProx gives you a unique domain for each host that you want to fuzz.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like this one actually just allows you to specify a URL equals in your like query parameter of your target, right? So it's like this one, there might be some weird encoding stuff with that or some weird gotchas there. So I would keep an eye out for that. Looks like it's passing through all your put and post and all that sort of thing, but it does allow you to be a little bit more flexible, as you can keep that worker up and use it to scan multiple different hosts if you want. So
yeah, more importantly, absolutely do not host that on a very guessable domain or something you use a lot, because if that's URL equals and it accepts anything, I'll dig into the code later. But that's ripe for abuse. So be careful on that front as well.
Yeah, I think this sort of a spin up, spin down as you do, you know, thing. But yeah, that's true. If you forget to spin it down, that could be that could be, you know, you could be paying for a lot of people's brute forces out there.
Yeah, I feel like as well now we're starting to get to the point where a lot of these ecosystems, like when Fireprox got released, right, AWS was really, I think, off the top of my head, one of the only ecosystems that supported it with the API gateways. Mm-hmm. We're now seeing a lot of other providers mature up into the point that they have like a competitor service offering. So now you've got these tools coming out. And when you combine it with Asset Notes Newtowner, you go, right, okay, I'm accessible from Cloudflare's IP range or I'm accessible for AWS. I've got that test sorted. Let's just spin one up here and you can have a lot of fun with that, I think. So yeah, it's quite nice to see how it's all playing out over time now that we're just bypassing all these silly defenses that people are putting out there.
Yeah. And I mean, there's definitely a little gray area with the, you know, agreements or terms of services with these, but hackers gonna hack. So
yeah, well,
we'll get our accounts banned, but.
Yeah, and I, when that came up on the episode, I was like, okay, I guess you have to say that as an employee, but come on, man. No one, a motivated attacker will not give an absolute hell about that.
Yeah, and that's what I told him too. I was like, look, man, we're all on the same side here. You know, like, as much as it feels like maybe sometimes we aren't, we are, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, I agree.
No, 100%. How are we doing on time? Are we okay?
Yeah, we're good. Let me just I'll do this next one real quick and then we'll wrap it. Is that cool?
Sure.
Okay. So just wanted to give a shout out because Itugulo, who is an excellent hacker, did a write up recently on Kaido 101. And if you read his blog, which I do, and all of you guys should as well, he credits his shift to Kaido, I think, with a lot of growth for him as a hacker, as somebody who was, you know, previously up and coming in the space, and I think now is pretty confirmed top tier hacker. And so he was talking about his shift to Kaido, and he wrote this Kaido 101, How to Master It write up. And he breaks down coming from burp, some friction points you might see, CLI versus desktop, breaks down all the various sections of the Kaido application, understanding concepts like HTTPQL, workflows, plugins, etc. So if any of you guys are looking to take the deep dive on Kaido and are looking to be led to the light, so to speak,
led
here,
to the light.
I'm looking at you, Brandon, then this could be a good read for you guys to kind of understand exactly how to do that.
Nice. Yeah, these sort of resources, I feel like when you're very much stuck in your ways, like I have been in BERT for forever, those are the sort of resources you want to find just to understand the capabilities, what you can do. And on that note, the Kaido scope, I've messaged you about it during that event, but man, please can that get changed really fast?
It is. So Kaido has a public issue tracker.
Okay.
And you can go to the roadmap. And one of the items on the roadmap right now is try to adjust the scope to be a little bit more compatible with hacker expectations.
Oh, man. I will fund my hard-earned British pound coins to get that implemented into the tool if I have to.
Gosh, I need it
because it was giving me a few problems in this event. It's, I guess, because of the current transition over.
Yeah, man. To be honest, like, I get it, but I use filters and it just works, you know, like that's what I use and it works fine. So it is a little bit of a friction point. It's definitely not as intuitive, but there is a solution. You know, you can do path-based filtering and very granular filtering on what you want to see in HTTP history using filters rather than scope.
But that right there is the key, what you just said. You can use HTTP filters. Now, there's a lot of extensions which solely rely on the scope. So your extension is absolutely hammered with everything when... Because I was seeing this mismatch because I did have a filter on, but then my extension was going haywire. And I was thinking, what is going on? And it's because it uses the scope. So
in scope.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Good feedback, man. I'll bring that to the team right after this episode.
Awesome. I'll fund it as well to get it pushed out if you want.
Great. I'll let them know. Thanks, man. All right. That's a wrap. That's the pod. Peace. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time, trust me. All right, I'll see you there.